Well, greetings, brethren. Hag HaSukkot Sameach. Happy Feast of Tabernacles. Beautiful music. Really appreciated that. That last stanza always is very inspiring to me when it says, when Christ shall come with shout of acclamation. And what joy will fill our hearts. But of course, we have a preview of that joy now. And we're tremendously grateful for that. My family and I really are enjoying being here in Florida, especially gathering here with God's people at the feast, meeting new people, seeing old friends we haven't seen for a good while. We're looking forward to meeting and talking with more of you as we're here, but that's what this is all about, is being together as God's people and enjoying this tremendous fellowship in anticipation of that wonderful future when that shout comes. Well, brethren, my sermon this afternoon is about temporary dwellings. There's nothing surprising about that. As we all know, that's why we're here. But let's examine the matter a little bit. I've titled the message, Seven Aspects of Temporary Dwellings. Notice God's instruction to the Israelites, you know, regarding how they observe this particular festival over in Leviticus 23. Let's go over to Leviticus 23, where we see all of the feasts of God laid out. It's the only place where they're laid out this way. Well, there's one other place where they are laid out as well, and it's where all the sacrifices are listed out, and that's in Numbers 28 and 29, I think. But here in Leviticus 23, we're given this tremendous listing of the festivals and what we're to do, what the Israelites were to do. And let's see what they were supposed to do and why. In verses 40 through 43, it says in Leviticus 23, 40 through 43, "And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees." And by the way, I'm very happy to see the palm trees around us, because we'd only see that at the feast, and it's very nice in light of what we read here that we have them around us. "But the boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. Verse 42, we'll skip. "You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." The Hebrew for booth here is sukkah, a tabernacle or a tent, a temporary dwelling. The plural is sukkot, which is the Jewish name for the festival. Actually, it's Hag HaSukkot is actually the Hebrew here in Leviticus 23, the Feast of the Tabernacles. The Jews just usually refer to it as Sukkot. The Israelites in Egypt had been in bad conditions of enslavement. But recall that they had homes to dwell in there. They put the blood of the Passover lambs on the doors and lintels, on the doorposts and the lintels of their homes. But when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they had no more doorposts. They were sojourners, constantly on the move, living in tents. Even God's tabernacle that was later built was just that, a tabernacle or a tent, a temporary dwelling for God, until the temple was built centuries later. But even it was ultimately temporary, as we'll talk about later when we go on. But brethren, today I want to cover, again, seven aspects of festival booths. Seven aspects of festival booths. Actually, originally I had five aspects, but I needed to get seven. No, I just noticed a few more things, and I decided I'll add those points in. But I could probably give a lot more points, and I'm sure, you know, we could come up with more reasons, but we'll stick with seven today. Number one, booths represent escaping this world and sojourning with God. Booths represent escaping this world and sojourning with God. Again, we see there in Leviticus 23, verse 43, God said to dwell in booths, and he gave a reason. He said, "That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. No, when I brought them out, that is from where they were no longer amid worldly civilization. They were out here on the move. And when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they were following the cloud, hiking and camping. They were escaping from this world, getting away from it all, so to speak, away from the ways of this world, this society and its evils, following the cloud wherever it led them. Let's look at Exodus 13. Let's see, I mentioned about that. Exodus 13. It wasn't just a cloud that they were following. Exodus 13, verses 21 through 22 here. Exodus 13, 21 through 22, after they left Egypt, it says, "And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people." And where did the Lord first lead them? I look back here at chapter 12 of Exodus, verse 37. They had gathered at Ramesses. That was their gathering place where they left from. But then it says in Exodus 12:37, "Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides children." We're talking about 2 to 3 million people here. It's a vast amount of people. And they went where? To Succoth. The Hebrew name Succoth probably was named for their encampment at this place. At this stage, they probably had a lot of makeshift dwellings, including whatever branches and bushes could be found, maybe some palms. And again, we have a representation here. Now, we may think of actual tents like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had, these great Bedouin tents, but these departing slaves may not have had many of these kind of tents among them yet. Remember, they didn't live in these when they were in Egypt. It would take time to make goat hair tents and other such shelters. So we see the need for branches to make lean-tos. But I always wonder, how could there have been enough for all these people in the desert wandering? It seems maybe the land wasn't as barren then as it is now, but it was still evidently pretty barren. They've done hydrology studies, and so we wonder, you know, seems to be another one of those Exodus miracles that there was enough foliage about for all these people to do this. Later, after they crossed the Red Sea, it mentions in Numbers 33 that they stopped at a place with 70 palm trees. Although that still wouldn't really be enough, would it? For 2 to 3 million people? But I'm guessing that they were dragging along some of what they found for shelter for a while. And then they got to Mount Sinai, and they were there for a year. And now they had time to produce more proper tents, but still not permanent structures, as they would soon be on the move again. They were following the cloud. And I should mention that the Jews view the color, they have an explanation. They view the covering of the pillar of cloud and fire as the Succoth, or temporary shelters in the wilderness. And it was that for the Israelites. Of course, we know they had actual physical structures, but for them to really be protected, they, you know, out there in the heat, they really needed that higher covering. And we'll talk about that more later. But let's turn it over to Numbers 9 to see what was happening with the Israelite journeying. Numbers 9. There's a lengthy passage here. Maybe just skim it. Numbers 9. Looking at starting verse 15. It says, "Now on the day that the tabernacle was raised up," that's God's tabernacle. So after they had built this temporary dwelling for God, this mobile sanctuary, "the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony. From evening until morning, it was above the tabernacle, like the appearance of fire." And so it was always. The cloud covered it by day, and the appearance and there was the appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud, verse 17, was taken up from above the tabernacle, after that the children of Israel would journey. And in the place where the cloud settled, there the children of Israel would pitch their tents. Now these were more proper tents probably by this point, because they'd been there for a while. At the command of the Lord, the children of Israel would journey. And at the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud stayed above the tabernacle, they remained and camped. And even when the cloud continued long, it says, verse 19, many days above the tabernacle, the children of Israel kept the charge of the Lord and did not journey. Anyway, it goes on, and it just basically says that sometimes it'd sit there for just overnight. Sometimes it'd sit there for a long time. Whatever happened, they would do whatever the cloud did. If it stayed, they would stay. If it went, they would go. Verse 23, at the command of the Lord, they remained encamped, and at the command of the Lord, they journeyed. And they kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. So the Israelites were sojourning. They were traveling through. And I'll point out, so was God here. He was sojourning, dwelling in a tent, or leading the march of the Israelites on their journey. So getting away, you know, from Egypt was not just running out of this world. It was going out to be with God, to be with God. You know, they had what's called the wilderness experience. I think, I don't remember if it was in our last issue or the one that's about to come out. Robin Weber wrote something about this wilderness experience that all of these various people in the Bible have had, where you go out into a sort of a desolate place to be alone with God. The Israelites were essentially sojourners even after they entered the promised land. Sometimes we don't realize that, but if you look over at Leviticus 25, Leviticus 25 says, and this is in verse 23, Leviticus 25, verse 23, says, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And he's talking about once they come into the promised land. You are strangers and sojourners with me. That's interesting. You know, well, we might say, well, this was God's land and they are just passing through it. And of course, that's true. The whole world belongs to God. That land certainly belonged to God. But also God had given this land to the Israelites by inheritance. So it might seem strange that while they're in that land given to them, they're still called strangers and sojourners with God. Yet that's how it's described. And we see the same thing from David over in 1 Chronicles 29:15. I'll just read this to you. David, in 1 Chronicles 29:15, this is what David prayed after the Israelites brought the big offering to build the temple. He said, for we are aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers. Our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope. Physically speaking, we're aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers, David said. That was still the case at that time. It's very interesting. These people come to their homeland, and they're still regarded as traveling through. This isn't really their ultimate homeland. It wasn't for them, and it's not for us, and we'll see that too. Solomon built the temple as a symbol of future permanence, not because permanence had actually been achieved. The transition from David's reign to Solomon's reign was a type of the coming of the kingdom and the millennial period to follow. David's time was a time of warfare and subduing enemies, which is parallel to putting down God's enemies at the end of this age. And then you have a kingdom of peace. Solomon's name in Hebrew is Shlomo. You know, it comes from Shalom. It means peace, peaceable one. He's a type of the Prince of Peace. That's not because Solomon was a weak ruler of a weak kingdom. He could have defeated any enemies, but he did not need to, because that had already been done at the time of David. David was not allowed to build the temple because he was a man of war. This does not mean David was a bad guy. We know that David wasn't a bad guy. David's time of warfare was directed by God to put Israel in an ascendant position above the surrounding powers, so that Solomon's reign would be a time of peace, a time of rest. The time from Moses and Joshua up to David's time was a time of war and struggle. when God dwelt in the mobile tabernacle. Then, with the time of peace under Solomon, comes the establishment of a more permanent structure in the physical temple. But obviously, this was all symbolic, because that physical temple did not last. And Solomon royally blew it. He did not carry out the righteous reign that he should have, because he did not stay in the way of God that he should have. As the true Prince of Peace will. Nevertheless, Solomon's reign still served as a type of the coming millennial reign. So we see this transition from the tabernacle to the temple as fitting with that. So much here is parallel with our own experience of living life today with its struggles on our way to the peace and rest of the world to come. I'll just reference for you, you'll hear more about this later, but 1 Peter 2:11, I'll just reference for you, calls Christians sojourners and pilgrims. Christians are sojourners and pilgrims. That's a description of us, brethren. Like the Israelites following the cloud, we follow Christ wherever he goes. He's taken us through different places, different locations, and even different organizations for some of us. Wherever the truth of God and his way settles, that's where we camp. He is leading us through the wilderness, and we follow wherever he goes. And we're looking forward to the day when we arrive at our final destination, the kingdom of God. And when at last Christ returns, we will be delivered from this world, just as ancient Israel was delivered from Egypt. But back then, Egypt was still there. The world society around us will be eliminated and replaced. So we will have left this world, this present society that will then disappear. We will have left this world to be with God. The feast is a foretaste of escaping this world to be with God, to come out of our routines and the ways of this world and gather as God's people together with him. So that's number one. We'll go to point number two, aspect number two. Booths represent God's protection. Booths represent God's protection. Turn over to Isaiah 4. This is a passage that's very heavily related to the Feast of Tabernacles, Isaiah 4. And I'll come back to this near the end of the sermon, but I want to read part of it now. Isaiah 4, read verses 5 through 6. It says, then the Lord will create above every dwelling place. This is in the kingdom. Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering, that is a huppah, is in the Hebrew. That's a covering you see in a Jewish wedding ceremony that the couple weds under. There will be a covering, a huppah. It ties into the marriage that will be taking place in the future. In verse 6, and there will be a tabernacle, a sukkah, for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, and for a shelter from storm and rain. The pillar of cloud and fire, brethren, is coming back. It's going to be over Jerusalem during the millennium, where Christ will be reigning. And we, his bride, will be there with him. It is going to be an awesome thing. And it will provide shade from heat and refuge from storm and rain. Sukkot, or booths, are shelters. And the pillar of cloud and fire was a shelter, God's protection from heat, storm, and rain. And as I mentioned, the Jews view the pillar of cloud as the wilderness shelters, or the Sukkot, more than the physical shelters that they put together. Of course, physical materials were useful, but they wouldn't have been effective without God's overarching protection. It's kind of like when we sing from Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord shall build a house, the weary builders toil in vain. unless the Lord, the city shields, the guards maintain a useless watch. So we can do what we can, but we really need what God does for the ultimate protection. Some interesting imagery over in Revelation 7. I'd like you to turn over there. Revelation 7. We might think of the palm branches as something that's only in the Old Testament in terms of observing the feast in Leviticus 23 and in Nehemiah 8, which we will later look at. But maybe we also might recognize this in the New Testament when Jesus entered Jerusalem on the donkey and the people cut down palm branches and they scattered them out before him. This was actually an element of the Feast of Tabernacles that was done at Passover time in special recognition of the arrival of the Messiah, which was, you know, pictured in the fall festivals. And there's some other historical significance to that, this as well, that I don't have time to go in here to, but I just want to say that perhaps it seems that this practice of palm branches is exclusive to the Jewish people and has very little relevance to followers of Christ at the end of this age. But let's take a look here at Revelation 7 and verse 9. Now, this is certainly symbolic, but we see this imagery here showing the ongoing relevance in the future and thus also for us today. Verse 9, talking about untold numbers of people who come to follow God at the very end of this age. It says, after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number of all the nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands. This is Feast of Tabernacles imagery here, the rejoicing with the palm branches. And we look down at verse 16. It says, they shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. This is a quote, by the way, from Isaiah 49:10. I'm going to look this up later. Isaiah 49:10, which describes the Israelite exiles coming back to their land from afar at the return of Christ. The second Exodus that Dr. Hoselton referred to in his message. No doubt, they will come with people of other nations, just as a mixed multitude went with the Israelites in the first Exodus. There will be people returning in great numbers to God at the end of this age. But my point here is the fact that these returning exiles are under God's protection. Here we see people with palm branches under God's protection against the elements, just as God protected the Israelites under the pillar of cloud and fire. So these two are under God's protection and care. And that's what's symbolized through the booths and through temporary shelters today. We still have the picture of ourselves under God's protection as we journey to the world to come and the covering protection and care that the whole world will experience at that future time. Aspect number three, booths represent harvest shacks. Booths represent harvest shacks. What in the world am I talking about? You know, Exodus 23, verse 16, you heard mention of this. It ties in with, it's called, we'll see what it's called here, about the Feast of Ingathering. We're going to look at that. But you had these harvest seasons that the festivals correspond to. You had, at the time of the Days of Unleavened Bread, the wave sheaf offering was the presentation of the first fruits of the early barley harvest, the early spring. And then Pentecost, you know, you had this grain harvest that transitioned to wheat, and Pentecost was the first fruits of wheat harvest. But we see that here in Exodus 23:16. It mentions the feast of harvest. Again, that's Pentecost, the first fruits of your labor, which you've sown in the field. And then it says, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you've gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. That is talking about the Feast of Tabernacles. Gathering the fruit was also mentioned in Leviticus 23. This festival is a feast of gathering in the harvest, which happened at the end of the summer. In Israel, this late harvest is a little bit earlier than it is over here. You know, we have crops still growing well into the fall. We have Thanksgiving, which is a harvest festival that was modeled to some extent on tabernacles. But again, in Israel, it was a little bit earlier. And the harvest seasons of Israel picture the harvest, not just of the fruits of the earth, but the fruits of ultimately the earth, in the sense that man was raised up from the ground, as we heard, from dirt. The harvest of humanity is what's really being talked about here. The smaller in the spring, representing this age, and the great end time harvest of humanity that comes in the millennium and the last judgment period to follow. Look over at Isaiah chapter 1, if you will. See something interesting here. Isaiah chapter 1. This is talking about bad things that were going to come on Judah because the nation was in rebellion against God. They were not doing as they should. Isaiah 1, well, verse 7 says the country is going to be desolate and burned with fire. But let's notice verse 8. Isaiah 1, 8 says, so the daughter of Zion, talking about Jerusalem here and the remnant in the land, so the daughter of Zion is left as a booth, a sukkah, in a vineyard, as a hut, in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. What this is saying is that the country would be pretty ravaged with only a few standing structures here and there. But I want to key in on what this description is based on. It's based on the fact that the people of ancient Israel and Judah would set up temporary shacks in the field while they were out working. And they would come in from their work for shade from the sun or shelter from rain and storm if that came early. And this was where they rested and ate. It was a place of temporary rest during the labor of harvest. And they would also stack up some of the harvest in some shelters for protection. The booths at the completion of the harvest, at the festival of booths, were reminiscent of these temporary shelters. And we can clearly see great symbolism in all of this. The imagery of harvest shacks looks forward to the millennial and last judgment period harvest of people of all nations. When we who are in training today will then be working in the field of this earth to help bring in God's great end time harvest. We will be celebrating in an ultimate sense at the end of the harvest period, of course, but we will also be rejoicing all throughout it. And here we are celebrating it today before it has even happened, just as we celebrate the other upcoming events pictured by all the fall festivals in anticipation of the certainty of their occurring. They are all these things are going to happen. That harvest will happen. And we can celebrate it now as a guaranteed event. Moving on to aspect number 4, booths represent fleeting yet abundant existence. Booths represent fleeting yet abundant existence. The Jewish people see in the physical sukkah or booth a symbol of human frailty. And when they build their booths, they maintain that the structure of the temporary dwelling must be flimsy. One place they take that from is Genesis 33. You can look over there, Genesis 33. This is another account of a place being named Sukkot. Genesis 33, verse 17. It's talking about Jacob. It says, and Jacob journeyed to Sukkot. Now, it wasn't already named that. Either he named it or somebody else did because of what happened here, as we read that here. It says, Jacob journeyed to Sukkot. He built himself a house, and he made booths. That is, he made Sukkot for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkot. So he made himself a house, built Sukkot or booths for his livestock, and that's why the place is called Sukkot. Notice he built a house. A house is a major structure for himself. And then he built Sukkot for his livestock. So these are clearly lesser structures. These are stables, essentially, but not even very permanent ones, evidently. In fact, in referring to a sukkah as a temporary dwelling, we should consider in the language that it's more of a temporary structure, not a permanent dwelling that we reside in temporarily, but the nature of the structure is temporary. You can see that from this verse very clearly. But I'll consider something else about that in just a moment. But before I do, I'd like us to look at something else. Please turn over, if you will, to Nehemiah chapter 8. Nehemiah chapter 8. Now, Mr. Oss touched on this in his message, and I'm going to give some further attention to it. Nehemiah 8. Following the return from exile, the law was read to the people, as we heard, and they discovered what they were supposed to be doing regarding proper worship. They observed the Feast of Trumpets, and then they followed with the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, there's something a bit striking here, and we address it in our UCG online Bible commentary. There may be another way to understand this, but the way I read this passage, it looks to me like the Israelites did not build booths for 1,000 years in their observance of the Feast of Tabernacles. Let's look at this in Nehemiah 8, verses 13 through 18. It says, "Now on the second day, that is the day after trumpets, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people, they gathered to Ezra the scribe." We're going to skip down to verse 14. "And they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths in Sukkot during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities in Jerusalem, saying, 'Go out to the mountain, bring olive branches, branches of oil trees, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of leafy trees, to make booths, as it is written.'" In verse 16, "Then the people went out and brought them, and they made themselves booths, each one on the roof of his house, or in their courtyards, or the courts of the house of God, and in the open square of the water gate, and in the open square of the gate of Ephraim." So all over the place, they built these booths. "So the whole assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and sat under the booths." And now here's the amazing statement. "For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, until that day, the children of Israel had not done so. And there was very great gladness." Also, verse 18, "Day by day, from the first day until the last day, he, Ezra, read from the book of the law of God, and they kept the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day, it was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner." Now, it may be that perhaps they just had not done this with such great gladness since that time long before. Or maybe they hadn't done it as the whole assembly. But again, it seems to me that what it's saying is that they had not built booths with these leafy branches since that earlier time, since the time of Joshua. The passage cannot, by the way, be saying that they were not keeping the Feast of Tabernacles for all that time. We know that because the returning exiles previously kept the Feast of Tabernacles in Ezra 3, verse 4. Ezra records that. They had already kept the Feast of Tabernacles. And Solomon dedicated God's temple in a two-week period that included the Feast of Tabernacles. The Israelites had been observing the Feast of Booths, but it seems perhaps not with booths of branches, including under righteous kings like David. That's kind of astonishing. Maybe they just thought that the palm and other branches were for waving and rejoicing, while the commandment about booths was satisfied by tents. Because if you look there in Leviticus 23, those two statements are not immediately together. You might be able to break them apart. Maybe they just didn't think they needed to have booths. Could be they thought they were already under a sukkah, since they had the pillar of cloud and fire there at the tabernacle and then the temple at Jerusalem. That cloud and fire was there. And we might note that the second temple of Ezra's time, though, did not have the pillar of cloud and fire. But at the time of Ezra, this aspect of worship, actually building booths out of branches, was restored. Now, today, people don't typically stay in an actual booth for the festival or even a tent, as in past years. There were times in past days of worldwide that a lot of people stayed in tents. People usually opt for nicer accommodations, seeing the need for a luxurious dwelling to rejoice in. You know, we're commanded to rejoice at the feast. It's not always so joyful in a booth. especially if it's really hot or really cold or if it's raining. Depends on where you are in the world, I guess. But let me say this. Brethren, even this imposing structure around us could be blown flat by natural causes. Auditoriums and hotels may be sturdier than lean-tos, shacks, or tents, but ultimately, they too are still temporary. Brethren, everything we see is temporary. Now, on the rejoicing side, it should be recognized that even a Jewish sukkah, though temporary and frail, can still be splendid and sumptuous. It is, after all, as they explain, a symbol of God's protection, hearkening back to the time that they dwelt beneath the protective covering of the pillar of cloud and fire. Even God's tabernacle was a sukkah, and it was very rich and splendid. Indeed, we often speak of our temporary quarters at the feast as typifying royal dwellings, and they should, as God's tabernacle did. But still, all physical things are temporary. Considering that the Jews view booths as representative of human frailty, it's interesting to note that the New Testament explains that our physical bodies are tents or tabernacles, temporary dwellings. Look over at 2 Corinthians 5. 2 Corinthians 5. It says in verses 1 through 4 here, 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 4, Paul writes, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Verse 2, "For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked, for we who are in this tent, in this physical flesh, groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life." We're looking for that new body. We see it also in 2 Peter 1. I'll just reference this one. 2 Peter 1, 13 through 14. Peter said in 2 Peter 1, 13 through 14, "Yes, I think it is right, as long as I am in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that shortly I must put off my tent, just as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me." So our earthly bodies are compared to these temporary tents that will be put off. And we will receive a new spiritual body at the resurrection. So we might think, well, are we supposed to have a miserable, horrible life? Of course, sometimes things don't go so well. There could be major problems in our physical existence. But God intends that even our physical lives be abundant and prosperous. John 10:10, Jesus said, "I've come that they have life and that they have it more abundantly." Third John 2, he said, "I pray that you may in all things prosper and be in health." This is what God generally wants for us, although he sometimes has us go through difficulties for our ultimate betterment. The point being that you can have this temporary, frail existence that is also richly rewarding and a blessing. And that's part of what is symbolized here at the feast. It's fleeting, yet abundant existence. This ties in with the encouragement that we often hear to make the most of the short time that we have at the feast. Just as we need to make the most of our fleeting physical lives in general. Read that in Ecclesiastes. And something on that that I included in the UCG online Bible commentary on Ecclesiastes, I want to read here. Our commentary states, and it quotes someone else here, it says, "The festival also fits with the fleeting nature of life today." Commentator James Lindbergh puts it well in Encountering Ecclesiastes, A Book for Our Time. This is on page 123 of his book. He said, "Sukkot, or tabernacles, is a celebration of the beauty of things that don't last. The little hut, which is so vulnerable to wind and rain, and will be dismantled at week's end. The ripe fruits, which will spoil if not picked and eaten right away. The friends who may not be with us for as long as we would wish. And in northern climates, the beauty of the leaves changing color as they begin the process of dying and falling from the trees. Sukkot comes in the fall. Summer is over, and sometimes the evenings are already chilly with the first whispers of winter. It comes to tell us that the world is full of good and beautiful things, food and wine, flowers and sunsets and autumn landscapes and good company to share them with, but that we have to enjoy them right away because they will not last. They will not wait for us to finish other things and get around to them. It is a time to, as Ecclesiastes 9:7 says, eat our bread in gladness and drink our wine with joy. Not despite the fact that life does not go on forever, but precisely because of that fact. It is a time to enjoy happiness with those we love and to realize that we are at a time in our lives when enjoying today means more than worrying about tomorrow. It is a time to celebrate the fact that we have finally learned what life is about and how to make the most of it. And then the commentary states, of course, in observing the Feast of Tabernacles, while we are learning to appreciate our many blessings today, we are also anticipating the permanence of life and joy yet to come. So again, it's fleeting. The feast is fleeting, but it is a time of abundance. And that was meant to be symbolized also in the booths that were dwelt in during this time. Of course, what makes it all worthwhile is the presence of God. Consider that we are not the only inhabitants of our earthly bodies. God inhabits us too. God inhabited a temporary tabernacle and physical temple, but he also inhabits our physical tents, our bodies. We're told in 1 Corinthians 6:19, I'll reference, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit that is in you? Just as we inhabit a temporary dwelling at this time, so too does God the Father and Jesus Christ in us. With God's powerful presence, our fleeting physical existence is exalted to the highest life possible in this age. Number five, aspect five. Booths represent the people of God together. Booths represent the people of God together. We just saw that our individual bodies are booths or tabernacles for us and for God. Consider also that the tree branches that form the festival booths spring from fruitful trees that are a symbolic of righteous people. And I will just reference for you Psalm 1:3. We sing it in one of our hymns. It describes the righteous man this way. You know, he shall be a tree that grows, planted by the riverside, which in season yields its fruit, green its leaves abide. So a tree by rivers of waters describes the righteous, producing fruit. We see elsewhere that the rivers of water, if you turn over to Isaiah 44, we see elsewhere that the rivers of water for these righteous trees or people is ultimately referring to God's Spirit. Now, there will be more about this at the feast, but I want to point to one place here that mentions the water and trees. And the trees, that's what I really want to key in on. But Isaiah 44, verses 3 through 4, God says, for I will pour water on him who's thirsty and floods on the dry ground. And I will pour out my Spirit on your descendants and my blessings on your offspring. They will spring up. And notice, it's the Spirit. The water is symbolic of the Spirit. But then it says in verse 4, they will spring up among the grass like willows by the watercourses. Now, willows are trees that soak up a lot of water. And so it will be that godly people in the millennium will be saturated with the Holy Spirit, as we should be today. But brethren, I want us to note the tie-in to the Feast of Tabernacles here. One of the prominent branches for the feast that we read of in Leviticus 23:40, as it says, is willows of the brook. It doesn't just say willows, it specifically says willows of the brook. So it specifically references it being beside the water. So in the booths of the branches and the fruit, the work and righteous fruit of God's people, that's what is being symbolized here, They are brought together for a unifying shelter of care for others. It's fitting that the Israelites, as the Jews still do, would invite others into their booths to feed and shelter others and rejoice with them. I'll just, Ephesians 2, 21 through 22, as a reference, refers to God's people. It says the whole building being fitted together, growing into a holy temple in the Lord, being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Think about this. We all become members, appendages, as it were, of Christ, hands and feet, arms and legs, who said that he is the vine and we are the branches. The branches that must bear fruit. We're told that in John 15, 1 through 8. These branches are interlocked together to form God's tabernacle structure, allowing all to be sheltered and provided for with thanks and joy. And here at the feast, God's people come together for this purpose in a wonderful way. This is all such a stunning picture. Aspect 6. Booths represent the millennial period. Booths represent the millennial period. We understand, brethren, that in the way that God's plan is laid out, the Feast of Tabernacles represents the time of the millennium, when God's kingdom will be set up on this earth. What might seem odd, though, is why that period would be symbolized by temporary dwellings. Temporary dwellings would seem to symbolize our time here and now in our physical body of this time, and not the time of the millennium. It could perhaps be argued that the point is to make us mindful of our current temporary dwellings so as to make us long for our future permanent dwellings. And indeed, there's likely some truth in that. But it seems more germane to the feast to consider this fact. The millennial period itself, along with the white throne judgment period that follows it, all of that is temporary. It too is a time of temporary dwellings or booths. Although the grandest, most wonderful, most prosperous, and most abundant temporary period ever. Of course, when we are changed at the resurrection at Christ's return, our spirit bodies will then be permanent, incorruptible dwellings. But the rest of mankind will still dwell in physical, fleshly bodies. And even for us, when we are spirit beings, there will still be an aspect of temporary dwellings. Because our dwelling place at that time, the surface of the earth, including the millennial temple in Jerusalem, will all be temporary. 1,000 and more years, yes, but still temporary. It is all going to be replaced at the time of the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem for which we wait, as we read about in Revelation 21 and 22. Remember what God said of Abraham. You look over in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11. God said of Abraham here. Hebrews 11, verses 8 through 10. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. And it's making the point of their dwelling in tents in a nomadic existence. It's drawing special attention to that. But that wasn't it. It says, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. It is the same for us, brethren, and we will still be waiting for that city to come down all through the millennium. Even while we are spirit beings, that permanent home, the New Jerusalem, will be in heaven with the Father to yet descend to the earth while we work in the field of this earth, reaping the great ingathering harvest of the world to come. It is an amazing and wonderful picture. Notice this too from the end of the millennium when Satan is released and leads Gog and Magog forces against God's followers. In fact, I won't have you turn to this one. I'll just mention it because it's very short. But it's in Revelation 20, verse 9. It's talking about these all these enemies being led up against God's people. And it says, they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. But what I want to draw attention to is it's called the camp of the saints. The millennial Jerusalem there is called the camp of the saints. It is a temporary dwelling, a time of camp encampment waiting for that permanence. Still, even though the millennial world and the millennial temple itself will be temporary, awaiting the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem, our wandering on this earth will at last be over. We will be, when we're in that the millennial Jerusalem even, we will be where we're going to be forever, not that we can't go anywhere else, but that's where we'll be rooted forever, even before that city comes down. Turn over to Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33, verse 20. You know, when we're finally established there in Jerusalem, verse 17 says, for the context here, he says, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. This is the millennial period here. Verse 20. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, a quiet home, a tabernacle, a sukkah that will not be taken down. Not one of its stakes will ever be removed, nor will any of its cords be broken. That is the place we will be forever, where the new Jerusalem is yet to be, even before it finally arrives. And there's an important sense of God's tabernacle continuing forever, as we'll see in a moment. But before going to that, brethren, please turn back over to Isaiah 4. We read part of this earlier. But I want to read more of it now. Isaiah 4. I really like turning to this passage at the feast, as it brings so much feast imagery together in one place. Here again is the future fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll start in verse 2 this time. Verses 2 through 6 we'll read. It says, in that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, beautiful branches. And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped. Again, this is Feast of Tabernacles imagery. But it's finding fulfillment. The branch is in various prophecies a reference to the Messiah, the branch out of Jesse. This branch out of David, that is Jesus Christ. And the blessings, this fruit that's produced, the blessings and the righteousness of God's people. That's what we're talking about here in an ultimate sense. But I'm sure there will be both a physical and spiritual. Verse 3, and it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem. Verse 4, when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the blood of Jerusalem from her by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning, there is a terrible destructive time coming, but it will purify. All those who are left, it says, will be holy. Verse 5, then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory, there will be a covering, and there will be a tabernacle, again a sukkah, for shade in the daytime, from the heat, for a place of refuge, from storm and rain. That, brethren, is the millennial tabernacle. We sing of it in one of our hymns. We sang it the other night. Glorious things of thee are spoken. Zion, city of our God, round each habitation hovering, see the cloud and fire appear for a glory and a covering, showing that the Lord is near. How amazing that will be. This will be our awesome home, yet still joyfully awaiting the permanence yet to come. Finally, I want to add one more aspect of what festival booths symbolize. Number 7, booths represent dwelling with God now and forever. booths represent dwelling with God now and forever. You know, God created this universe as a habitation for not just us, but also himself. And I will just refer you to Isaiah 40, verse 22. Isaiah 40 through 22 says, "It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in." The imagery here is believed to come from these dark Bedouin goat hair tents. From inside, you'd see a covering of blackness with tiny pinpricks of light piercing all through, you know, all these tiny holes all over the mesh of the fabric, thus seeming like a sky of stars. Solomon said that the heaven and the heaven of heavens could not contain God. Yet God has stretched out this heavenly tent of the universe to dwell in, and he placed us within this tent. We have been made to dwell with God in his dwelling. Of course, a tent is a temporary structure, and this physical universe is ultimately temporary. As we've already noted, we wait for the permanence of the new heavens and new earth with the new Jerusalem. Yet even in that permanence, we still have this ongoing sense of tabernacling with God. Turn finally to Revelation 21. Revelation 21, reading here in verses 2 through 3. Revelation 21, verses 2 through 3. "Then I, John, saw the holy city," that city for which we wait, brethren, "New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride for her husband, as a bride adorned for her husband. And this will be the home of the bride. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God.'" And we look down a few more verses and are told that he who overcomes, I guess that's in verse 7, yes, "he who overcomes will inherit all things, the whole universe and everything, the spirit realm. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son." We will be God's children, dwelling in his dwelling, his household, his family forever. Ultimately, God will dwell with humankind and we with him, again, together in the same tabernacle. And God will forever abide in us and we in him. Remember when Jesus said, "The Father, I'm in him and he is in me," but that's the way the whole God family will be. For we will be, as we heard earlier in the sermonette, the God family for eternity. All of us together with God in his dwelling, made everlasting. And for all this and all God gives, we give thanks and rejoice. So, brethren, while we're here rejoicing at this feast, let's be mindful of these aspects of booths or tabernacles, escaping this world and sojourning with God, being under God's protection, finding shelter and rest while laboring in God's great harvest of humanity, experiencing fleeting yet abundant and joyful existence, the people of God working and bearing fruit together as branches of the true vine for the sake of each other and the rest of mankind, picturing the most awesome time of temporary dwelling ever, the millennium, while waiting for the eternal permanence of the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem yet to come, and dwelling together with God, both now and forever. Brethren, what a wonderful life we've been given, and what a wonderful future is in store. The world, indeed the universe, under the rule and protection of the great God, indeed the God family, whom God is building up together to share existence with him today and through the coming ages and for all eternity. Have a wonderful and uplifting remainder of this awesome Feast of Booths.